Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, presenting Secrets from the White House.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do President Obama and Supreme Court Justice Chief Justice John Roberts view the power and purpose of the U.S. Constitution, and how have those different interpretations played out in the way each man has approached his job? When Obama and Roberts shared the stage at the president's swearing-in ceremony in 2009, famously botching the text of the oath of office, my guest today says the country saw one man who believed in change, looked forward, and was in a real sense a visionary, and another who believed in stability, hearkened back, and in matters of law was a conservative. The catch, as he will tell us, is that the man looking ahead was Roberts, while the one invested in preserving tradition was Obama. Jeffrey Toobin is a staff writer for The New Yorker and senior legal analyst for CNN. His new book is called The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court. Jeffrey, welcome back to Think.
Good to talk to you again.
So it would seem that the president and the chief justice have everything and nothing in common. Talk about that.
Well, they are two princes of the meritocracy. They are both products of the Chicago area. Obama, as we all know, became a community organizer there. And John Roberts was born and raised in northern Indiana. They both went to Harvard Law School. They both were prominent on the Harvard Law Review. And they both have a lot of charm and intelligence, but they see the Constitution, they see politics in very different ways.
Do they respect one another?
You know, they don't have much to do with each other. I think to the extent there is a personal relationship, it is one of wary respect. But it's not really a friendship. They recognize each other as formidable people. That's for sure.
How does Justice Roberts view his role? Is it actively political as well as judicial?
Well, when you ask a Supreme Court justice whether they view their role as political, invariably they say no. But you don't have to look too closely beneath the surface to recognize that what Supreme Court justices do has a tremendous political implication. All of their constitutional decisions have a strong flavor of politics to them. I don't say that as criticism. I think it's inevitable. I don't think there's any way to do the job of Supreme Court justice in a somehow apolitical way. But they don't like to acknowledge it, and they don't talk about it much.
Are there any legal limits whatsoever on the contact justices can have with partisan political leaders, that sort of thing?
Well, you know, there used to be a lot more contact between Supreme Court justices and presidents. Both Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman used to play poker with sitting Supreme Court justices who were close friends. Abe Fortas was giving advice to Lyndon Johnson in the White House when Fortas was on the Supreme Court. The rules, though unwritten, are more strict now. They don't allow for that kind of contact. You may remember there was a controversy a few years ago when Antonin Scalia went duck hunting with Dick Cheney. They tend to keep a distance from one another.
Mm-hmm. Now, in multiple cases, the Roberts Court has reversed narrow rulings from lower courts and replaced them with broader rulings. Talk about the general implications of that, and then we'll talk about some specific cases.
Well, the key fact about this Supreme Court is that there are five Republicans and four Democrats, and they are modern Republicans. The moderate Republicans who dominated the Supreme Court for years, Lewis Powell, Sandra Day O'Connor, David Souter, they're all gone now, and modern conservatives dominate the court, and they rule accordingly. Certainly the signature issue of signature decision of the Roberts Court, and one that I spend a great deal of time on in the oath, is Citizens United, which was a decision that did not have to be one that revolutionized campaign finance, but it did, and it did so in a way that helps Republicans a great deal. So whether that was the motive or simply the effect, it certainly was at least the effect.
How did the scope of Citizens United change once it arrived in the Supreme Court?
Well, when the Citizens United is such a great story to write about because there's so many moving parts, and it was such a complicated, interesting case with a great cast of characters, which included Elena Kagan arguing her first case as a lawyer ever in Citizens United. It was Sonia Sotomayor's first case as a Supreme Court justice. And the case itself involved a movie that a nonprofit group wanted to show about Hillary Clinton during the 2008 primaries. But the FEC said it was a commercial, not a film, and said it couldn't be broadcast in conformity with the McCain-Feingold law. The Supreme Court, instead of ruling about this case alone, used the case as an opportunity to transform all of campaign finance law to say that corporations are people and money is speech.
And so David Souter left the court extremely bitter about the outcome of that case.
He did. Souter came from an older Republican tradition of moderation, of restraint, and he thought that the court really went out of its way to change the law in a way that they didn't have to. And that was a deeply disappointing, even embittering experience, and it really was the signature of he was going to leave anyway, but he left with a sour taste in his mouth.
And he wrote this scathing dissent, but there was a re-argument that happened. This is another one of those really fascinating moving parts. Can you talk about how Chief Justice Roberts sort of kept the Souter dissent out of the record?
Well, what happened was, this was this sort of narrow case about a obscure, fairly obscure corner of campaign finance law. But after it was argued the first time, the conservative justices wanted to use it as an opportunity to really revolutionize the law. And the liberals really got very angry about that. And Roberts came up with a very artful way of, if not diffusing the liberal anger, then dealing with the problem. What he did was, he asked for the case to be re-argued a second time. That was something that had not happened before at the Supreme Court since, for more than a decade, a re-argument of a case. But they re-argued the case on the grounds where they made clear what the stakes were, which sort of diffused the procedural objections without changing the outcome. And the second time it was argued, the result was the same as the first.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about what the justices' questions mean when the attorneys are arguing their cases? I think a lot of people assume that they are trying to inform themselves, and as it turns out, that's not really what's happening.
Yeah, I mean, it really goes back to Chief Justice Rehnquist's tenure as Chief Justice. He was a guy who believed that good fences make good neighbors. The justices really didn't interact with each other that much. And as a result, they rarely had each other as a captive audience except during oral argument. During oral arguments, they had to listen to each other. And the justices started using their questions, not so much to ask questions, but to to sort of make statements, to make campaign statements, that's continued under the Roberts Court, that the questions really mean more than the answers. They don't play devil's advocate. They use it as they use their questions as an opportunity to campaign among their colleagues.
Is there evidence that they are any less intractable than the average, middle class American voter watching coverage on TV?
I think they're about the same. I mean, these issues are deeply political, and they feel strongly about them, and not a lot of minds gets changed. I mean, I've asked Supreme Court justices, how many times has your mind changed during an oral argument? And, they say two or three times a year, maybe.
Okay, so let's talk about this idea that conservatives on the court now are really trying to remake the way we understand the Constitution and the way we look at it. There's this question of originalism. And first, if you would define that for our audience, then we'll talk a little bit more about it.
Well, originalism is the idea that the Constitution should be interpreted and understood only as the way the framers of the Constitution in the 18th century understood it, that how they understood the words, what they thought the meanings of the words, are frozen in time. And the opposing view is that that the Constitution is a living document which can be understood only in terms of its contemporary meaning. It's an idea of, as Justice Scalia, the famous originalist and conservative, says, I believe in a dead Constitution. The Constitution is as it was written in the 18th century, and anything else is judges just making it up.
Okay. Is it possible to know and to sort of look at the framers as a monolithic body of individuals?
Well, one of the many critiques of originalism is that the framers often disagreed with each other. But also, how do you apply their understanding of the world to the modern world? There's a great example of that. You know, during the there was a case last year about whether California could regulate violent video games. And Justice Scalia was asking a series of questions. And Justice Alito jumped in and said, what I think Justice Scalia is asking is, how did James Madison feel about video games? Did he enjoy them? Which I think captures some of the problem with originalism, that, you know, when you're talking about video games or wiretapping or drone strikes or so many parts of modern life, it's very hard to draw precise lessons from the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I suppose there's the question of the spirit of what the framers meant, and maybe that is more possible to achieve.
Well, that's right. I mean, but once you start talking about the spirit, you are very close to saying, well, we have to decide what it means. It's very much like what the more liberal justices say. So, you know, that's what that debate, that tension is part of what goes on.
How recent is the rise of originalism as a really significant force on the conservative side of the court?
Well, Robert Bork was the first very prominent advocate for it, but certainly Antonin Scalia is the person most associated with it, and he was appointed in 1986, and Clarence Thomas, who was appointed in 1991, is also an even bigger believer in originalism. The other conservatives on the court some grounds for agreement with originalism, but not, they don't buy the program as much as Scalia and Thomas do.
So Justice Kennedy technically falls under the conservative side, but many people see him as a swing vote. Can you talk about the kinds of issues that cause him to go to one side or the other?
Well, you know, I think it's sometimes a misnomer to refer to Justice Kennedy as a moderate. He's not a moderate. He actually has very strong views in a variety of areas. He's just somewhat unpredictable or mercurial in his views. You know, he tends to be very conservative on criminal law, on civil rights. He was with the conservatives in the healthcare case. But on gay rights and on the death penalty, he has definitely been on the liberal side.
Mm-hmm. And the First Amendment is a big deal for him as well. I mean, as it is,
yes,
for all the justices,
but he is. Again, there's, when it comes to Citizens United, which he wrote, there's a great deal of disagreement about what the First Amendment really means. But certainly he cares a great deal about the First Amendment.
My guest this hour is Jeffrey Toobin. He is a staff writer for The New Yorker and senior legal analyst for CNN. His new book is called The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court. If you'd like to be part of the conversation this hour, you can join us on the phone at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, presenting Secrets from the White House Kitchen, lecture, book signing, and hors d'oeuvres October 16th with Chef John Hanney III. More at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Jeffrey Toobin is my guest this hour. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker and senior legal analyst for CNN. His new book is called The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Jeffrey, many people were taken by surprise when the High Court upheld the Affordable Care Act. What can you tell us about why Justice Roberts ultimately sided with the liberals on the court?
Well, anyone who watches me on CNN knew that I was among the most surprised by the decision. I predicted otherwise, and I was certainly proved wrong. I think you have to start with face value. I mean, just say he was. He wrote that he was persuaded that the law was a legitimate tax as opposed to an exercise of the Commerce Clause, and I think that's certainly part of the reason. But I think it's a little more complicated than that, too, because Robert sees himself as the institutional custodian of the Supreme Court, that he is the embodiment of the court for the public, and he does not want to see the court viewed as just another place where Democrats and Republicans fight. There are five Republicans and four Democrats on the court, and this case was in many ways the third part of a trilogy: Bush v. Gore 2000, mm-hmm. Citizens United 2010, the Obamacare case 2012. These were decisions that were highly partisan in nature, and Roberts wanted to avoid that if he possibly could. So he found this vehicle, this technique of this other ruling, the taxing clause power, as a way of departing from the partisan orthodoxy, and that's how he resolved the case. But I don't think anyone believes that Roberts suddenly discovered his inner moderate at this point. He remains a very conservative justice.
It's hard to decide about how to feel about the idea that Supreme Court justices are thinking about public perception when they make these calls.
You know, it would be nice to think that they are completely insulated from that. But, you know, this is the real world, and these are very worldly and sophisticated judges, these nine. And I think it's entirely appropriate for them to recognize their place in the constitutional system, the power that they have, unreviewable power to overturn statutes. That is something that they can only exercise with a great deal of knowledge of how the American political system works. And so I have no problem with how they go about it.
So this argument that Roberts made, that insurance, the individual mandate, was legally okay according to the Constitution because the federal government does have a right to tax its citizens, there's that element. And then there is the fact that he also said, however, this is not justified by the Commerce Clause. Talk about the importance of the Commerce Clause and how that opinion might ultimately weaken it down the line.
Right. You know, ever since the New Deal, Congress has used the Commerce Clause. Congress has said that under its power to regulate interstate commerce, they can regulate much of the national economy, pass minimum wage, have Social Security, allow labor unions to function. All of it has been done under Congress's power under the Commerce Clause. This decision was, at least theoretically, a limitation on the Commerce Clause power because they said the Commerce Clause did not justify the individual mandate. I have my doubts about what the practical significance of that is. I think the Supreme Court is not looking to invalidate large numbers of federal statutes under the Commerce Clause, but Roberts did at least lay the groundwork.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to John in Dallas on the phone. Hi, John.
Hi, how's it going?
Great, thank you.
First I want to say I actually finished reading The Oath last night. It's a great, great read.
Wow, thank you.
My question is, I wanted to get your opinion on lifetime appointments. If you see that there's any problem with, I mean, because sometimes these individuals have this outsized influence for, you know, 30, 40 years. Do you see any problems with that? And do you think maybe there should be, I mean, that we should maybe temper that influence that these individuals have over this long, long period of time?
I definitely think there's a problem with lifetime tenure. Look, the Constitution was written in the 18th century when people, by and large, died in their 50s. I mean, the idea of 30-year tenures was almost unheard of at the time. And now, you know, presidents time their Supreme Court appointments with younger judges so they can have these outsized influence. So there are a lot of people who have talked about mandatory retirement at some age or some kind of term limits. I think it's a good idea. A couple of law professors have a very good idea, which says that there should be staggered 18-year terms, so each president appointed two justices. But frankly, I think the difficulties of amending the Constitution are so great, which is what it would take to change it, that I don't really see it happening anytime soon or perhaps ever. So it's a problem, but it doesn't command the kind of concern that would be required under the in order to amend the Constitution.
Of course, any Supreme Court justice that a president is able to appoint really does have a long-term effect, far beyond even a two-term time in office for a president. Can you talk about President Obama's sort of approach to this, and what you imagine might happen if he is elected for a second term?
Well, you know, one of the paradoxes of the Obama presidency is here's a man who was a constitutional law professor. He taught it at University of Chicago for a while. Yet he has not shown a great deal of interest in the Constitution or even in judicial appointments. he has not even filled all the vacancies on the Supreme Court. The Republicans, on the other hand, have been extremely aggressive in fighting his nominees and pushing for their own nominees during the Bush administration. It's just a big difference between the parties right now. I think Obama is quite properly proud of his two appointments to the Supreme Court, Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan, and I would expect any further appointments he have to be in that vein, sort of moderate Democrats. But it's not clear that he will win the election or that he will get Supreme Court vacancies to fill.
Sure. Now, in terms of the lower court appointments, has he been distracted by other things, do you think?
Well, I do think he has been distracted. I mean, it's been a busy time. He's had two wars, a huge recession. It's a paradox that he has not exercised this power to its fullest extent. I also think Obama feels, he's written this, that he thinks liberals look too much to the courts for change and that politics is really the answer. So that's just sort of how he's oriented. And that's been reflected in his presidency.
Have you ever given any thought to what sort of Supreme Court Justice Barack Obama might have made?
Well, you know, I've actually thought about that a lot. When he was running against Hillary Clinton in the 2008 primaries, with my flawless talent for prediction, I predicted that Hillary would win the presidency and she would appoint Obama to the Supreme Court. I think the court is long overdue to have a politician on it, and given his background, he would be an interesting choice. I don't really see it happening at this point, but he could wind up like William Howard Taft, after serving as president, going on the Supreme Court. But I'd say the odds are against that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. We have an email here from Madeline who says, talk about Sandra Day O'Connor's activism these days. If only she'd held on for a few more months, she might not have resigned. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, Sandra Day O'Connor is really one of the epic figures in all of American history. I mean, so influential, so important. And she has really cut a new path for herself in retirement. She has become very politically active, and she has done it in a way that shows how alienated she is from the modern Republican Party. I mean, one of the big themes of the oath is how much the Republican Party has changed, and that is very much reflected in O'Connor's tenure on the court and her subsequent activities. She's fought a lot for judicial independence, against judicial elections and an appointive judiciary. These are all causes very much associated with Democrats, and she's been very outspoken.
You know, we've talked in other programs on this show about the country's overall shift to the right in the past couple of decades. But if you move far in either direction, either to the right or to the left, eventually you come up against a wall. I mean, do you think this could happen with the Supreme Court?
Yeah, I think they're a ways off from the wall, though. I think they are, they're a lot more conservative decisions. They haven't outlawed affirmative action. They haven't overturned Roe v. Wade. They haven't expanded Citizens United every way they could. All of that is quite possible if they get a few more appointments to the Supreme Court. I mean, that's really what the stakes are of this election. And, you know, we'll see. Whether they get the chance.
We have an email here to think@kera.org from Mark in Fort Worth, who says, if the originalists believe the Constitution is fixed, shouldn't they stop judicial review as it is not part of the document?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think, you know, one of the things that Justice Scalia says is he calls himself a faint-hearted originalist, meaning, you know, he doesn't go entirely by what he thinks the framers would have wanted. You know, he recognizes there are many precedents of court decisions since then, starting with 1803, Marbury versus Madison, the case that establishes the concept of judicial review. But that is a problem with originalism, that if you really believe it, you have to explain some real oddities. I mean, there's what about judicial review? What about segregation? I mean, segregation is something that was certainly enshrined even after the Constitution was amended in the after the Civil War. So, you know, that's one of many problems with originalism.
Another justice who seems to have left after being very disheartened was Stephen Breyer. Can you talk about the 2006-2007 term of the Supreme Court and his sort of sense of what had gone on?
Well, I hasten to add that Stephen Breyer has not left.
Oh, forgive me. I'm very sorry at the end. Sorry about that.
He'd be very sorry. He'd be very unhappy to hear that.
Thank you for the correction of my very dumb mistake. Yes,
no,
continue.
No, but I mean, but you were right in a general way that he was deeply alienated. I mean, one of the things that Breyer, you know, Breyer is someone who has worked collaboratively with Republicans. When he worked on Capitol Hill for Senator Kennedy, worked very closely with Senator Strom Thurmond's staff. He is someone who is very, who is not an especially partisan person. But when he saw the direction the Roberts Court was going, he was deeply alienated and has struggled to keep hope alive, as it were, for the causes he believes in.
What kind of strategy goes into the assignments of who will write the opinions for the court?
Well, this is a real area of artistry and leadership at the Supreme Court, because the official rule is that the Chief Justice gets to assign any opinion in which he is in the majority. If he is not in the majority, the senior associate justice in terms of tenure on the court gets to assign who writes the opinion. Now, obviously, that power is especially useful when the chief can assign opinions to himself, give himself the big cases. But sometimes, if there's a member of his coalition, especially in a 5-4 case, who's kind of a shaky vote, who might want to go over to the other side, you give the opinion to that justice so that he or she writes the opinion, and that's the way to keep him on board. John Paul Stevens, when he was the senior liberal on the court, gave several important opinions to Justice Anthony Kennedy, whether it's Lawrence v. Texas or the Boumediene case about Guantanamo. Those were Kennedy opinions in order to keep him on board as a member of a liberal majority.
And can you tell us about the degree of communication that goes on between the justices, not only those who might be trying to persuade their colleagues, but those who are sort of in the same position but want to decide exactly how to articulate their arguments?
You know, I think most people would be surprised is how little communication goes on among the justices. I mean, they communicate by memo, not emails, memos about the opinions. But, you know, it really operates as nine separate law firms. There is not a lot of collaboration among the justices in almost all cases.
Is it different among their staffs?
Well, the clerks talk, and the clerks have a lot of contact. But, you know, the law clerks think they're very important, but in fact, they're not all that important. I mean, they do a lot of the drafting, but the power is really with the justices, and they're the ones who do the votes.
Does it ever get personal?
You know, it does, but short term. The justices are savvy people. They understand that, you know, the justice you're angry at today, you're going to need his or her vote tomorrow. And, you know, yes, they got angry. Certainly the conservatives were angry and disappointed that Roberts abandoned them in the health care case at the end of last term. But it tends to be short term because, you know, they need each other's votes.
How surprising was the fact that the 2010 State of the Union address that the president talked openly about his disappointment with the Citizens United ruling?
It was 2010, and you know, the timing was significant. The Citizens United case was 6 days before the State of the Union, so it was very much top of everyone's mind. And I thought both Obama's speech and Justice Alito's reaction, where he mouthed, "Not true," I thought that both were great. I thought they were great because they were a useful window into what really goes on at the Supreme Court, that there are intense political differences, and it was good to let the public see it.
Jeffrey Toobin is with us. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker and senior legal analyst for CNN. His new book is The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court. Join the conversation now at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, presenting Secrets from the White House Kitchen, lecture, book signing, and hors d'oeuvres October 16th with Chef John Hanney III. More at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Jeffrey Toobin. We are talking about his new book, The Oath, How the Obama White House and the Supreme Court. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here from Tom who writes, "I correctly predicted the Roberts vote on the Affordable Care Act, but erred in assuming that Alito would join him. Unlike the traditional conservatives Scalia and Thomas, the new conservatives tend to be pro-corporate more than any other defining attribute. In his long career, it's difficult to find a ruling where Roberts ruled for an individual over a corporation. Once I isolated the corporate interest, I could and have always been able to predict Roberts' vote." What do you think about that, Jeffrey?
Well, he's got one over on me since he predicted it and I didn't. You know, it is certainly true that Roberts has been very pro-corporate in his orientation, very pro-defendants in civil litigation. You know, whether that allows you to predict 100% of the time, I can't say. But he certainly, you know, if he got that case right, he's ahead of me.
Let's talk about some of the other justices arguing that case or taking part in that case. Elena Kagan really had amazing foresight before she was ever nominated to be a Supreme Court justice. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's really an extraordinary story that, you know, she understood that the case of health care might wind up before the Supreme Court, even before she was nominated. And so in a series of emails, which I, you know, which I quote in the oath, she went out of her way not to participate in any discussions about the health care case. And that really preserved her place in the court. That made it possible for her to not recuse herself,
right,
for her to participate in the court. And you know, it that her vote was the difference between winning and losing for the Obama administration. So those emails turned out to be extremely important.
Yeah, and were they not available, there would have been no way to prove that she did not take part in this conversation.
That's right, and she knew that, and it was very, very significant.
Okay, let's talk about Justice Thomas. There were people who said he should not have been taking part in the case on health care.
That's right. He was largely because of his wife. His wife is a veteran political activist. And she was very outspoken against the healthcare case and healthcare law, and people thought he should recuse himself. I actually thought he did the right thing in staying in the case. Ginny Thomas, his wife, is veteran political activist. She's been involved in politics since before she even met Clarence Thomas. They're a two-career family. They've always been a two-career family. They had no financial stake in the outcome of the case. But so I just don't think there was any reason to him to recuse himself. The real reason Democrats tried to get him recused is that they knew how he was going to vote. But that's not a legitimate reason for recusal, as far as I'm concerned.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Steve in Oak Cliff. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Chris. My question is, what's the importance of a dissenting opinion, and can it be used to change law later on?
You know, that's a great question, because some of the justices themselves have questioned the need for dissenting opinions, because, you know, it's only the Supreme Court that can overrule their own decisions. But sometimes Congress can change the meaning of a law that the court is interpreting. And for example, in the Lilly Ledbetter case, a case that involved sex discrimination law, Ruth Ginsburg wrote a dissenting opinion that was really a roadmap for Congress to change the law. And in fact, Congress did in the first law that Barack Obama signed as president of the United States. They have no legal effect. But they have a moral authority that is quite that can be quite significant, and it's something that that all the justices do sometimes, you know, some more than others, and I think basically they all accept that it's necessary.
How are cases built in the lower courts and sort of crafted to make them ideal for consideration by the Supreme Court?
It happens. I mean, you know, the Supreme Court gets about 7,000 cases a year on appeal, and they accept about 70 or 80 cases a year. So the odds are 100-1 against any individual case being accepted for review. I think there are specialists in Supreme Court litigation, and they know how to frame a case where the justices might work agree to accept a case. But even with experts, it's a long shot.
Can you talk about Justice Scalia's positions on gun control and on the rights to bear arms, and how they have really affected the overall position of the court on guns?
Well, I mean, this was a triumph of originalism, as we discussed earlier. You know, Scalia believes that the original intent of the framers was that the Second Amendment, which, as I'm sure many people know, has two parts. A part that refers to a well-regulated militia, and the other part refers to the right to keep and bear arms. The National Rifle Association and many conservatives over many years really mounted a sustained assault on the traditional understanding of the Second Amendment. The traditional understanding of the Second Amendment was that the only the militias, the state militias, had a right to arms, and that individuals did not under the Second Amendment. But in the Heller case in 2006, the court embraced the understanding of the Second Amendment that gave individuals a right to bear arms, and that was something that Scalia was able to bring to a majority in the Heller case in 2006.
I mean, is it safe to say that that was not an originalist position?
Well, that was highly contested. Chief Justice Stevens wrote a dissenting opinion where he said his reading of the originalist of the framers was that they did not think they gave individuals a right to keep and bear arms. So, I mean, this just underlines one of the problems with originalism, that it's just often very hard to know what they thought.
Can you talk about the diversity of the court today in terms of gender and race and religious background and political affiliation and how those things have sort of shifted over time?
Yeah, I mean, one of the great things about the Supreme Court is that membership is sort of a touchstone of the coming of age for immigrant groups and religious groups in the United States. And, you know, and then in the mid-19th century, there started to be a Catholic seat on the court because Catholics started immigrating in significant numbers. You know, after the turn of the century, the last century, you had Louis Brandeis, the first Jewish justice, at a time when there was a lot of Jewish immigration. 1967. Thurgood Marshall, first African American. 1981, Sandra Day O'Connor, first woman. 2009, Sonia Sotomayor, first Hispanic. The timing is not coincidental, but at the same time, you know, there's a declining significance to some things. There are now 6 Catholics and 3 Jews on the court, no Protestants. But I think that is just a coincidence. I don't think that is terribly significant because those sorts of religious differences don't matter in the way that they once did.
So religious difference doesn't matter as much, but it sounds like ethnicity and race continue to matter a great deal.
You know, I think what really matters today is ideology, more than ethnicity, more than race. You know, Sonia Sotomayor and Samuel Alito were not picked for the court because they are Catholic. They were picked because they were liberal and conservative. I mean, the ideology is really the defining difference between the justices, and that's the most important thing now.
So this upcoming year should be a very big one for the court. Handicap for us what might happen, the cases that might come to bear on things like same-sex marriage and voting rights and affirmative action.
Those are all likely to come up this term. There's a case, I mean, as I'm sure you know, in Texas, from the University of Texas, about affirmative action, which could certainly change the nature of college admissions and, in fact, all affirmative action. The future of the Voting Rights Act and then the Defense of Marriage Act, the constitutionality of that, and perhaps even same-sex marriage.
So are you out of the predictions business now in terms of way these things might shake out?
I haven't learned my lesson, and I'll despite my vow to stick to predicting the past rather than the future, I will venture the guess that they will cut back on affirmative action in the Texas case. I think they will take the Defense of Marriage Act case and overturn that, but I don't think they will take the Proposition 8 case, and they are not willing to risk the political heat of telling every state in the union they have to have same-sex marriage.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to James in Dallas. Hi, James.
Good day.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Yes, I have a question for your guest. Most states, most people, most citizens of the United States recognize and know that our criminal justice systems of the states, counties, are corrupt. What power does the justice system of the United States have, and what involvement do they have in this matter? I'll take the answer off the air, please.
Thanks for your call. I guess we have to start with whether or not you agree with the assessment that most people think the criminal justice system is corrupt. What, do you want to start with that, Jeffrey?
Well, the court has a limited function. I mean, whether you think the criminal justice system is corrupt or not, it's not really up to the courts to fix it. I mean, if you're talking about prosecutors and defense lawyers, I mean, they can address corruption in any given case, but it's really up to the political system to, you know, throw out the crooked DAs, or if that's what you're talking about, or have legislators investigate and change the arrangements in courts. You know, the courts, especially the Supreme Court, can only decide one thing at a time, and they, by and large, that's all they do. So they can't decide. They can't save the world. I mean, they are only one part of the legal system.
There have been people that argued, and you mentioned the president sort of feeling this way, that we spend too much time looking to the Supreme Court to decide contentious issues for us, and we need to go back to the legislature. I mean, relatively speaking, do you feel as if the Supreme Court wields more power today than Congress?
You know, it's rare. They wield a lot of power, but they don't wield it all the time. You know, my favorite comment about the Supreme Court is by Justice Robert Jackson, who said, "We are not final because we are infallible. We are infallible because we are final."
Hmm.
Somebody has to have the last word, and the Supreme Court has it. But most of the time, they don't exercise that power. They don't. They don't strike down laws. But when they do, there's no appeal. That's it.
Tell us just a little bit about the process by which new justices are brought in, shown the ropes, made to understand what the traditions are. Because from what I understand, there are a lot of sort of formal, unspoken rules about how things happen day to day in the Supreme Court.
Right. I mean, for example, the court hears arguments sort of Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday, and then on Friday morning, they meet in the justices' conference room, which is sort of the holy of holy events at the Supreme Court. No secretaries, no law clerks, just the nine justices, and the junior justice, now it's Elena Kagan, is responsible for answering all knocks at the door and taking notes on what goes on. That's the junior justice's role. The oral argument has a rhythm. You know, the chief justice or the senior associate justice usually asks the first questions, and then the younger justices defer. Everything at the Supreme Court is done by seniority order. And the chief justice, even though he hasn't been on the court that long, is always considered first in seniority. So whenever they line up, whenever they do anything in terms, it's always seniority order. Is the way they go.
Jeffrey Toobin is a staff writer for The New Yorker and senior legal analyst for CNN. His new book is called The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court. Jeffrey, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thanks, Chris.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.